Welcome to World War I Centennial News. It's about World War I news 100 years ago this week, and it's about World War I now. News and updates about the centennial and the commemoration. World War I Centennial News is brought to you by the U.S. World War I Centennial Commission and the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. Today is April 19, 2017, and I'm Teo Mayer, Chief Technologist for the World War I Centennial Commission and your host. Let's go back in time for a look 100 years ago this week. The war with Germany is approved by a wide margin in Congress, but it's still unclear how much support it has among the American people. So, on April 13, by executive order, President Wilson creates the Committee on Public Information. This new and powerful committee is headed by a guy named George Creel, a newspaper man who's a long-standing ally of Wilson's. You gotta love history, right? The committee also has representatives from the State, War, and Navy departments. Their mission is to write news items, create pamphlets, posters, and even publish their own newspaper. They send out 75,000 speakers across the country to promote the war effort. Put bluntly, the government fires up its first propaganda ministry to support the war agenda. Check out the full story and see what this new 1917 Committee on Public Information is all about by following the link, either in the notes or the chat room. Looking at what's going on in Europe, we're bringing in Mike Schuster, former NPR correspondent and curator of the Great War Project blog. So, Mike, things worked out pretty well originally for the Canadians and the Brits on the Vimy Ridge campaign, but new fighting tactics and new tank technologies fail, and a lot of good men lose their lives for very little gain as things go on. Tell us the story.
That's right, Teo, and the details are tragic. The headlines read, "New disasters on the Western Front. British and Canadian forces stymied by the Germans. Outcome in France all too familiar." And this is special to the Great War Project. A century ago, there are tragic developments on the Western Front in France. The combined British and Canadian force launches simultaneous offensives at Arras and Vimy Ridge. The first stage is successful. The German line is penetrated, and 5,600 German soldiers are taken prisoner. The British and Canadian force, according to historian Martin Gilbert, overruns almost the whole of the German frontline trench system in just 45 minutes, the second line just a short time later. By nightfall, Gilbert reports, even part of the third German line was in British control. The Canadians were also successful in the first hours, taking 4,000 prisoners. But the result is not all roses for the Allied force. The third German line is much better defended. In this offensive, the British employ a new tactic. They call it rolling or creeping barrage. As historian Gilbert describes it, the artillery would move systematically forward while the infantry followed close behind, taking advantage of the artillery in stunning and disrupting the defenses. But soon the Germans reversed the momentum of the attack. As Gilbert describes it, the German third line, so much better fortified than any previous line, held fast against the renewed assaults hurling against it, even when parts of it were taken. The British tanks cannot keep up with the infantry and they fall behind, trapped by the mud and mechanical difficulties. On the third day of the battle a century ago, the British force hits a snowstorm. The next day, the offensive is resumed after the British obtain intelligence that the Germans are bringing up reinforcements. Nevertheless, the British infantry are given orders to attack. This order is met with incredulity. Still, the British commanders send in the cavalry to penetrate what seemed to be a widening gap in the German lines. The battle continues for a third day, and now German reinforcements arrive. For many of the British attackers, three consecutive days in action had brought them to the limit of their endurance. Nevertheless, the British commander orders another assault. On April 14th, a century ago, at Vimy Ridge, the Canadian contingent gains 4,500 yards of the German line. They take 4,000 German soldiers prisoner, but at a cost of almost 3,600 of their own men killed and more than 7,000 wounded. That day, reports Gilbert, three British generals defied army tradition by protesting directly to the British commander at the mounting casualties. Finally, on April 15th, the offensive is suspended. The results of the British attack are tragically familiar. A dent of 4 miles had been made along 10 miles of the German front line, but at a terrible cost. Nearly 36,000 soldiers killed, a total of 136,000 killed or wounded. The Germans suffered 125,000 casualties. And at Vimy Ridge, 11,000 Canadian soldiers die, buried without identification at 67 cemeteries there. The following day, the French opened their own attack, labeled the Nivelle Offensive after the French commanding general. It, too, is a disaster. Those are sadly the details of the story for this week from the Great War Project.
Thank you, Mike. Mike Schuster and the Great War Project blog. It's the middle of bloody April in the Great War in the Sky 100 years ago this week. I found it interesting and actually a bit disturbing that the language about these early days of aviation sometimes sound like some sort of sports adventure game. But the life and death struggles in the sky were very real. Though the references may speak of scoring wins, these are in fact duels to the death. The charisma of these escapades are fully exploited by the propaganda machines of all sides, using the technology of aviation to crown new champions, aces, and heroes. In one such reference, on April 11th, Baron von Richthofen scores and is lauded for his 41st kill, surpassing his mentor, Boelcke, with a record of 40. And as Mike talked about, on April 16th, French General Nivelle launches a major offensive south of the Somme. Now, this is stopped by the Germans, and in an attempt to assist, Britain's Royal Flying Corps cranks up a really high sortie rate, resulting in extremely high losses. Meanwhile, on the ground, the extreme high French troop casualties bring on a French army mutiny. This is a war-weary time in Europe. In the U.S., on April 20th, preparing for joining the battle near Pensacola, Florida, the U.S. Navy flies the DN-1, the first U.S. airship. America, energetic and pumped, is preparing to enter the fray. And that's the war in the sky 100 years ago this week. We were speaking with the folks from the Great War Channel on YouTube last week, and they told us that with the April 6th commemoration and the PBS series coming on, there are a lot more people tuning into their short videos on the history of World War I exactly 100 years ago. And they do it from a more European perspective. We encourage our podcast listeners to check it out. This week, the Great War Channel's new episodes include Western Front Artillery. The second one, Smoke Screens, Fortress Locations, and Recruitment Age. And the last one, The Canadian Corps Takes Vimy Ridge, The Battle of Arras. A story we touched on this week as well. Now let's zoom forward in time to World War I Centennial News Now. News and updates about the centennial and the commemoration. Starting with activities and events. This month, on April 25th, the Department of Defense will be hosting a history speaker series event called Perspectives on American Entry into World War I. The series will be held at the Pentagon. Speakers include Dr. Thomas Bogart, Dr. Robert Doty, and Jennifer Keane, covering topics that include U.S. military intelligence operations in post-war Europe. It sounds interesting, and we welcome the DOD to the national conversation on World War I. There are a couple of links in the chat room or the podcast notes for you to learn more. Also in Washington, D.C. this month, on April 30th at noon, in Washington, D.C.'s Pershing Park, the planned future home of the National World War I Memorial, there'll be a ceremony to commemorate Lieutenant Colonel John McCrae's timeless poem, In Flanders Field. This is considered the world's most famous war memorial poem. I don't know if I can do it justice, but here it is. In Flanders fields the poppies blow, between the crosses, row on row, that mark our place, and in the sky the larks still bravely singing fly, scarce heard amidst the guns below. We are the dead. Short days ago we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders fields. Take up our quarrel with the foe. To you from failing hands we throw the torch. Be yours to hold it high. If ye break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders fields. The poem is printed on our Poppy fundraising kits, and you can take a look and read the poem at www.cc.org/poppy. And if you look in the FAQ section under there on why poppies are such an internationally recognized symbol of military sacrifice, you'll find the actual poem itself. But back to the ceremony. This is the third annual event sponsored by the In Flanders Field Fund, a nonprofit organization created at the centennial of the poem. The fund hopes to keep the poem's message alive through education and inclusion while delivering on its directive to continue making the world a better place. The links are in the chat room. Okay, it's time for updates from the states. We had Bill Betton from the California World War I Task Force on the show a few weeks ago. Today, we'd like to congratulate Bill and the entire task force for their hard work on the California World War I Centennial website, which went live this week. And I happen to know, largely due to the great effort from Bill himself, who took on that project as a personal challenge and contribution. You'll find the site at www.cc.org/California, all lowercase. This site's going to be a focal point and a valuable resource for the California World War I information and commemoration efforts. Congratulations to California. Now let's widen the lens with our international report. From the UK, the headline reads, "Sunken World War I cruisers given war grave status to save them from the scrap heap." Three British cruisers sunk by a single German submarine in the First World War were given protected war grave status. The cruisers, HMS Cressy, Aboukir, and Hogue, were sent to the bottom of the sea about 20 miles off Holland around September 1914, leaving 1,459 sailors dead. It was feared illegal salvage operators would plunder the wrecks. Each of these are worth a fortune in scrap bronze, currently priced at over $4,800 a ton. The Ministry of Defense has designated the wrecks under the Protection Military Remains Act that protects military vessels in UK waters or, when British flagged, in international waters. Follow the link to read more. A second story. Here's an international story that has its roots in the U.S. From the BBC, the headline reads, U.S. Navy, quote, Jack the Lad, unquote, deserter turned World War I military hero. Former U.S. Navy sailor Leroy West, a.k.a. Jack the Lad, was in UK's 4th Battalion Regiment in Palestine. The sniper was honored with a Hero's Medal after the Second Battle of Gaza on April 19, 1917. West survived the war, but then disappeared from all records, probably going to ground in order to hide from U.S. authorities seeking him for desertion. Check out the full article to discover the secret identity of this World War I hero. Okay, it's time for posts and articles, highlights of the articles and features from the World War I Commission's news blog at www.cc.org/news. The first article, the U.S. Coast Guard plays a key role in World War I, both here at home and overseas. To help tell that story, the Coast Guard joins the national conversation on World War I with a remarkable new webpage full of stories, photos, and other goodies. Scott Price, the Coast Guard's chief historian, is interviewed by the commission this week and talks about the new page and the Coast Guard's contribution to the Great War. We should probably invite Scott on the show sometime soon. It's a really good story. In another article, this is interesting, as many as 19,000 men and women from the city of Lawrence, Massachusetts may have fought in both world wars. Next month, City Councilor Mark Leplante will fly to Europe for an 8-day trip through 5 cemeteries in France and Luxembourg, where 45 of the Lawrencians killed in the war are buried. At each of these graves and memorials, Leplante will plant the city of Lawrence's blue and white flag. Read the interview on the site where he talks about this upcoming trip and the research that went into finding these local heroes overseas. This week on our Wright blog, celebrated author and former Air Force pilot James Mode II connects the tragedy of the Great War to modern conflicts. This post is represented in a dramatic prose reminiscent of a monologue one might find in a play. Mode's poetic skills and wordcraft is truly on display in this post. Don't miss it at www.cc.org/WWRITE. Moving forward to the spotlight in the media, there's a lot going on. On the newsstand this week and almost sold out, the 2017 Time Special Edition, World War I and the War That Shaped Our World. This is a 94-page edition loaded with poignant photos and stories. Also this month in the magazine world, The Atlantic has a special issue out called World War I, How the Great War Made the Modern World. This issue takes a more contemporary look at the war with articles like Why Don't Americans Remember the War? And Yes, It Could Happen Again. You can find both of these issues at your local grocery store, at newsstands, and they're also available online in both digital and print formats through all major online retailers. The word is that the special print editions are selling out fast, so if you're interested, grab them. I picked up the Time magazine article, and it is really amazing. Then in film, we've discovered a unique piece of World War I media this week. Believe it or not, there's a World War I dance film out there, and it's called Young Men, choreographed by Ivan Perez. Young Men is a feature-length film starring British dance company Ballet Boys and based on a stage production of the same name. The film follows a young soldier as he prepares for war and as he eventually experiences war's destruction and brutality. The full film is available now, and you can follow the links in the chat room or the podcast notes to see it. It's time for the buzz, World War I and social media. We have Catherine Akey with us to guide us through the social media conversation wall. Hi, Catherine.
Hi. Well, this week we've continued to see an increase in the volume of articles being shared and interacted with across social media, which is amazing. We expected interaction and the volume of conversation around World War I in the States to continue to rise since April 6th, and that is in fact what we're seeing. One of the coolest articles that we saw this week that we shared on our Facebook page is an article from Under the Radar, military.com's entertainment blog. It's an article featuring photos of American doughboys preparing to head out for the front. The images come from training camps all across the country and in a couple unexpected places: Plattsburgh, New York, San Juan, Cuba, Fort Riley, Kansas, Spartanburg, South Carolina, and Camp Devens, Massachusetts are a few of the locations featured. There's images of soldiers with their mascots, including a monkey and a bear. There's soldiers shaving in preparation for an aerial photography classes, mending their coats. Soldiers writing messages of good luck in chalk on the side of transport trains, including messages like Berlin or bust, smoking out the Kaiser, and send Pershing's boys lots of bull and bullets. They'll do the rest. They're really fun photos, and they give a glimpse into all of the daily life and preparations that were going on in military camps across the country in 1917. A second story from this week shows another side of the preparations going on in the U.S. This one's from the National Archives blog, Unwritten Record. Recent post spotlights the manufacture of military airplanes during World War I. It features screenshots from a film reel, which you can watch at the bottom of the article, showing the whole range of activities that went into this immense production line of planes. We see lumberjacks working in pairs to saw down spruce trees, rows of engineers in ties sitting at desks going through paperwork, engineers bending strips of wood to form the body of the planes, and women in coveralls with their hairs pinned back, fashioning small metal pieces essential to the planes and stitching Irish linen 150 yards for every plane. Finally, we see pilots and planes scuttling across open fields, testing and quality checking the final products. It's a beautiful bit of footage, and I highly recommend you go to the National Archives Unwritten Record blog to watch it. Finally, there's a new book available on Amazon that looks like an incredible opportunity to glimpse into the experience of one doughboy. Private First Class Dick W. Baker wrote 32 letters home that chronicled his tour of duty. The letters provide a unique insight into the life in training camps and along the train routes as America rushed troops and equipment to the Western Front. This new book, called The Journey by D. Kent Decker, commemorates Dick's service amongst the turmoil that gripped the country during the hurried years of 17 and 18. We're looking forward to reading it and learning more about the war through one doughboy, Private Baker's eyes and words.
Okay, that's it for World War I Centennial News this week, and thank you for listening. We want to thank our guests, Mike Schuster from the Great War Project blog, Catherine Akey, the Commission's social media director, Justin Mickens, our line producer, and I'm Teo Mayer, your host this week. The U.S. World War I Centennial Commission was created by Congress to honor, commemorate, and educate about World War I. We rely entirely on donations. No government appropriations or taxes are being used. Our programs are to inspire a national conversation and awareness about World War I. We're bringing the lessons of 100 years ago into today's classrooms. We're helping to restore World War I memorials in communities of all sizes around the country, and we're building a national World War I memorial in Washington, D.C. All of this work depends on your support. So please give what you can. It's easy by texting WW1 now to 41444. That's WW1 now to 41444. World War I Centennial News is brought to you as a part of that effort. We want to thank the Commission's founding sponsor, the Pritzker Military Museum and Library, for their support. The podcast can be found on our website at ww1cc.org/cn and in the iTunes Store at WW1 Centennial News. Our Twitter and Instagram handles are both at WW1CC, and we're on Facebook at WW1 Centennial. Thanks for joining us, and don't forget to talk to somebody about the centennial of World War I.